You're listening to Ian Stone's Comedy Breakfast, the podcast edition. I'm here on Love Sport Radio every weekday morning at 6:30. I'm joined by Jimmy Carter. Morning, Jim.
Good morning, Ian.
Jimmy, do you mind?
Jimmy Carter, Jim, it's all good, mate. It's
James?
My dad used to call me James.
Yeah, but so, only when you were naughty, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Right, okay. You got a middle name as well?
I've got two.
Two middle names?
James William Charles Carter.
So if you were being naughty, would you go James William Charles Carter? What have you been doing?
No,
because my parents would do Ian David Stone. What's going on?
Oh, that really?
That sort of stern, yeah. It was using my full name. Wow. As soon as I used my full name, I thought, I've done something.
You're in trouble.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. This is Love Sport. Chris Froome is in intensive care and not in great shape after suffering serious multiple fractures in a high-speed crash. His team principal, Dave Brailsford, told BBC Sport. Apparently what happened was he was riding the Critérium du Dauphiné. This is the sort of warm-up for the Tour de France. And he wasn't even racing in the race. He was just riding the course just to have a look at it, see what it was. And I tell you what, Dave Brailsford explains this, doesn't he? Let's have a listen to what he has to say.
He was at the foot of the descent. It's obviously very gusty today. And it sounds like he's taking his hand off his bars just to blow his nose, and the wind's taking his front wheel. And he's hit a wall at 60k an hour, something like that. He's got a bad fracture. He's badly injured.
Yeah, I mean the injuries are bad. He suffered a fractured right femur. I mean, that is nasty. Mm. That is traction, isn't it? Yeah. A broken hip, a fractured elbow and fractured ribs, and lost consciousness following the crash. Brailsford said he's been operated on to make sure the first phase of medical care is as optimal as possible, and we will manage it from there. It's an evolving situation. It is concerning. There is no doubt about that. He's not in great shape. There are crashes and bad crashes, and this was a bad crash. Listen, it is inherently dangerous riding a bike down a hill or a mountain at 50 miles an hour.
Top
plus.
Speed. Oh,
I mean,
gosh.
These guys do not hold back. He wasn't racing, but he's doing 54 kilometres an hour. So, what, just under 40?
Yeah.
I mean, he's moving.
On a bike, that's quick.
On a bike, that is, well, in a car, that's fairly quick, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, listen, you know, you can hurt yourself in a car at 40 miles an hour, but on a bike, he came down a technical descent onto a straighter piece of road with houses either side. Yeah. And he signalled to his co-rider he was going to clear his nose, and he took his hands off the bar and a gust of wind took it. Well, listen, I mean, accidents happen.
They do. Having said that, Chris Froome is a very, very experienced rider. You'd have to say, was that a good decision? Clearly not. Taking your hands off the steering, off the handlebar.
Got to blow your nose at some point, but maybe not when you're doing 54 kilometres an hour. I mean, maybe, listen, I don't want to criticise him, though, because this is a guy who's a four-time winner of the Tour de France.
Exactly.
Knows how to ride a bike.
Yes.
Knows what he can and can't do on a bike.
Absolutely. You just wonder there was talk about a bit of a gust of wind. Just as he went to blow his nose, a gust of wind taking the front wheel, and moving it off kilter. So, listen, serious injuries. We obviously wish him very well in his recovery.
Did you have a serious injury? Did you have any serious injuries?
I was very lucky, do you know, Ian. Because normally when you get to about 35... which is, you know, back in the day, that's when you really finished. If you went to 35, you had a good career. But normally by that time, you've had two or three operations, maybe more, knees, ankles. I was very, very lucky, probably because I'd never tackled.
I was going to say, you never made a tackle in your life.
Never made a tackle in your life. Well, you've seen me playing. So you know, that's...
that's exactly what I was thinking. I'm glad you admitted it, though.
That's what we're all about. You're still going to get
chased down and hacked down
and kicked
by brutal fullbacks and all the rest of it. And no doubt in training as well, that would happen.
Well, absolutely. Although I didn't really tackle that much in my career, it wasn't really my forte. There was other players in the team that really done that.
You weren't a guy to get the ball. Jimmy, go and get the ball back and then give it to you. You were the guy who they give it to you.
Give him,
and then
give
go and take someone
exactly.
on.
Exactly. But the flip side is obviously you're getting kicked, you know, and all of that. So, but there's also wear and tear. But normally by 35, like I say, you're getting two or three operations. I had I ruptured my medial ligament when I was at Arsenal. Put me out for about 4 months. Wasn't great. And the only operation I did have was a back operation at the tail end of my career, and that actually eventually finished me off. I had to retire from football.
Is it okay now?
Back is fine now. I still play charity matches, which is absolutely brilliant. Still play for the Arsenal charity side, which I love. I mean, 53 years old and still pulling on the shirt and the boots. I love it.
those injuries at the end, I mean, we're talking about Chris Froome. He's 34 years old, right? I mean, yeah. I mean, he was meant to be essentially the lead rider for Team Sky, as it was Team Ineos now last yeah. year. Then, what's the name of the Welsh? Geraint Thomas yeah. came in yeah. and won the Tour de France. And he's almost certainly lead rider at this point.
Yes.
We know that Froome's not riding it this year.
Yeah.
Do you think he can still come back next year and reclaim it and get to the very top again?
At 34. So he's coming towards the tail end of his career. He'll be really frustrated that he's come out of the Tour de France not being able to ride in it this year. Off the back of what he's done there. He'll want to get back, I'm pretty sure, get back to full fitness. Apparently it's going to take him a good year, 12 months out, which is a long time. It's not as if he's 23. So he'll have to bear that in mind. But yeah. it's all about the hunger and the determination when you get to the tail end. Do you want to continue?
I mean, we've talked about Andy Murray quite a bit on this show, and Andy Murray's come back from this hip resurfacing operation, and he's starting to hit the ball.
yeah.
But tennis is a very different thing. I mean, in the yeah. end, tennis, you need lateral movement. You need all sorts of ways you move in tennis.
Yeah.
Whereas cycling, if things are fixed, if bones that were broken have been
yeah.
fixed
yeah.
and it all works again,
yeah.
you just got to get back on the bike. I'm talking more about psychologically. I mean, look, these guys must have come off the bikes, their bikes hundreds of times from when they were kids.
Yeah.
It's something they're used to. They wear helmets. Hopefully they're okay.
Yeah.
But this is a big old crash yeah. at the tail end of his career.
Yeah.
Whether he can... I know it's not what they say, but it's just like riding a bike. You just get back on. But there yeah. must be a point when you think, can I put myself through this again?
Do you know what I would say, Ian? Chris Froome, multiple serial champion, is a champion. He's a champion. So when you are a champion, you've got the mindset of a champion. He will come back stronger, fitter, probably arguably even fitter structurally wise in terms of his physical fitness, more so. I can see him coming back and challenging, and it's a challenge for him. He'll be sitting now in hospital thinking, right, let's get these operations done. How quickly can I come back? How much stronger can I come back next time? And that's the mindset of a champion.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. I've got a list of quite odd sports injuries, and I'm sort of, I don't know. I mean, the guy is obviously in hospital in a very, very poor shape, and I don't want to make light of it, but it is... Everything is quite fragile, isn't it? Let's be fair. And you can hurt yourself in any number of ways that will stop your career. To give an example, Roger Federer hurt his knee running a bath for his twin daughters.
That's a strange one. How does that happen?
Did
he burn himself on the towel?
I don't think it would have been that. Maybe he bashed it on something, a hard edge. I don't know. I mean, I hurt my hip getting out of a car.
Right.
So, you know,
you're getting on, though, aren't you?
I'm getting on a bit, obviously. you know, well, yes, that's right. I mean, we were talking about this, the fact that, you know what, there is a point very soon when if I fall down, I won't have fallen down, I'd have had a fall, right? It's a very different thing. Did he fall down? No, he had a fall.
Yeah, fall.
When you get to a certain age, you've had a fall, right? And once you've had a fall, dear, if you had a fall, you're all right, as opposed to, oh, no, I just fell down, I got straight up again.
Yeah.
But when you get to a certain age, these are sportsmen we're talking about, sportsmen and women. I'll give you an example here.
Yeah.
Darius Vassell, who we've spoken to a number
classic,
of times on this show, he drilled through his toenails with a home power drill.
Right.
He'd been... Oh, my God. I hadn't even seen this before. He'd been suffering from a swollen toe and thought his solution would relieve the pressure and drain some blood.
Right.
Needless to say, it didn't. Part of the toenail had to be removed after it became infected as a result.
Right.
Yeah, it's not ever... I don't ever think power drills are ever used in... in operations, they sometimes drill into the side of the head, but I imagine they're sterile. This probably wasn't cleaned properly.
Let me tell you something. Darius Vassell, he's a good lad, not the brightest. Not the brightest. I mean, what has actually convinced him? Does his missus go, you know what, there's a drill in the garage. Go and get that. Go and drill your toe and you'll be all right for Saturday.
Drilled into his own big toe.
I mean, come on. That's a ridiculous decision. I mean, football players essentially are not good at DIY anyway. He's tried to mix the DIY with rehabilitation and getting himself fit.
I don't know where his thinking was. He didn't really think that through.
He didn't play it for 3 months.
Ian Wright hurt himself on a bungee before.
I was there.
Yeah, you were saying this. Yeah. You were talking about this.
Pulled a hamstring.
And who was the manager then?
Well, it was George Graham was the manager, but George had actually went home to, it was his daughter's wedding.
Yeah.
So
Stuart Houston was left in charge. And Ian Wright ends up with a hamstring injury 2 weeks before the start of the season.
And Stuart's got to then go back and ring up George Graham to say, oh, by the way, Wright is not going to be fit for the opening game of
the
season.
That's not very, very good at all. No, I would say, and we got one more here, and I don't know who this is. Sven Grondalen, okay. Is a Norway defender, went for a jog in the woods to improve his stamina and ended up crashing into a moose. Well, right. I mean, who hasn't? Who hasn't? I mean, if I had a pound for every time I crashed into a moose, he caused him to roll down a hill and sustain a cut in his left leg, forcing him to withdraw from an international fixture against Finland. Yeah, I mean, look, it wasn't the moose. Essentially, what the moose was a large, solid object. Have you ever seen a moose?
They're massive. Moose. I've never been that close to a moose, but I've seen one in
pictures. I have seen one, and they are enormous. Yeah. I mean, they are twice the size of horses.
So has he missed the moose?
Well, he wasn't looking where he was going.
Maybe the moose just jumped out behind a tree.
I don't think moose. It's the same plural as singular.
He was hiding. He's having
moose was he's, hiding he's, behind he, a very big he, tree. He,
yeah.
I mean, look, we understand that that injuries happen with all sorts of nonsense. And look, the thing with Chris Froome is, I mean, first of all, we wish him well. He's in bad shape at the moment. He's lying in intensive care. And I don't want to make light of how badly hurt he is. Maybe when he recovers, he will look back and go, God, blowing my nose. I hurt myself. I crashed into a wall, blowing my nose. Maybe the lesson is not to take your hands off the handlebars when you're doing 54 kilometres an hour. But like I say, this guy knows what he's doing.
Love sports.
Just watching a replay of Australia playing Pakistan yesterday and beating them. Pakistan are actually in danger of going out. They looked pretty good against England when they played, but the Aussies beat them well. David Warner got a century, was of course booed by pretty much everyone. Although, as Chandresh said, there's been Mohammed Amir, 5-year ban, has just come back. That's worse cheating certainly than what happened with Sandpaper Gate or whatever you want to call it. I mean, there are various cheats in cricket. And why does David Warner get stick? I think because he showed almost no contrition at all until he was almost forced to. It's like we essentially made him cry and then we went, all right, but it's still very grudging, isn't it? That's the truth of it. Anyway, Andy, what have you got?
What haven't I got? Got bounteous treasures
got all
of
sorts
today.
Go on.
That's not another thing I want to add to my dating profile. He's got all sorts. okay. Well, do you want to do the Joe Brand battery acid
stories? Can talk about that, actually. I wouldn't mind talking about that. So basically, what is the story here?
So the story is, and this is all over the Sun, all over the Daily Mail, who are very keen to get any anti-BBC stories. Joe Brand, firebrand comedian, on a BBC Radio 4...
Firebrand? What? Firebrand comedian?
She's got strong opinions and multicoloured hair. I mean, that's enough to be a firebrand.
We've all got strong opinions. I haven't got multicoloured hair, but I do love Joe. I do love Joe. She's one of the nicest women in show business.
All right.
And I've known her for a long time.
She's quite cross on the TV.
Do you know what? She's cross with the right people, in my opinion. But go on.
All right. Well, we'll do the story. So she's on Radio 4 show Heresy. Where she's talking on air, she says, of the latest milkshake gate where people are chucking milkshakes at political figures, why bother with a milkshake when you could get some battery acid?
Right.
When she's talking about Nigel Farage.
Okay.
This is live on Radio 4. So this isn't in some dingy night.
It's not live, actually. It's not live. It was recorded and they decided to put it out because I've read one of the comments about it was that it wasn't even a live show. They heard it and they thought it was acceptable and they put it out.
Well, that's one point. The other thing I'd say is it wasn't happening in some dingy comedy club where it's in the context of an outrageous comedy performance where people have had a drink late at night. This is going out Radio 4, anyone can listen to it.
It's a comedy show, right?
Heresy, I'd imagine it's an outrageous comedy.
It is a comedy show. I'm asking you that in a rhetorical way. Of course it is a comedy show. Right. So I'd imagine that there aren't people sitting at home going, Joe Brand says I should throw battery acid over Nigel Farage. I'll go and do that, right? I mean, it was said in the context of a comedy show. Yes? I'm asking the question.
I'm not familiar with Radio 4's Heresy, but I imagine it's a comedy show chosen by the title and Joe Brand's on it.
So, and it's Joe Brand saying it as well, by the way, who is a comedian. Now you might like her or you might not like her, but she is a comedian. She's not seriously suggesting. It's not like that guy, Carl
Benjamin.
Carl Benjamin, right? Thoroughly horrible person, it seems to me, right? And some of the things he said. But he was standing for UKIP and he made a comment about, I wouldn't even rape Jess Phillips, right? And when they came back to him, he said, it was a joke. Now, it's one thing politicians or somebody who wants to be a politician making a joke. Joe Brand is a comedian.
You're quite, but you can't excuse Joe Brand's joke, which isn't particularly clever in light of all of the problems with Joe Cox's murder, etc., etc.
You can't conflate those.
But saying against an even worse joke doesn't make it better, does it? I mean, she's on the BBC where anyone can listen to it. And the nature of radio is you tune in halfway through things and you maybe don't get the full context.
Just turned it on and all they heard was a woman saying, we should throw battery acid over Nigel Farage. I am outraged. What do you want from comedy on the radio or on TV? Do you want it just bland stuff where no one is hurt? Is that what people want? Surely the whole idea is to push the boundaries. By the way, the show is called Heresy, which is you're meant to say things which I guess are heretical in some way. What do people want from their comedy?
My point is, I do agree. I think that comedy has got a little bit too safe in certain regards, and certainly it's become very left-wing in certain areas. We had that whole thing the other day. We had a discussion about that comedy show where anything goes comedy show and it's anti-PC. We were having a discussion about this last week. However, what I would say is maybe the BBC shouldn't be running this kind of thing. I mean, they did have the opportunity to save Jo from herself and maybe say, do you know what, Jo? That joke did step across the line in the current climate.
Do you think it did step over the line in the current climate? Do you, Jimmy?
I think just slightly. And the reason I do say that, Ian, and I get that Joe Brand is a comedian and the show that she was on was a light-hearted comedy show. However, I think because of, you know, the acid attacks that are out there, probably a little bit distasteful. At the very least.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
who decides?
I take your point.
I mean, the point is, I guess, who decides what isn't tasteful? I think that we all have different viewpoints as to what isn't tasteful. I've made jokes in a live setting, certainly, that people have gone, really? But they're jokes. They are jokes. I mean, I don't like to say that because quite often they're not really jokes. But I think the point is someone has to decide. In this particular case, you could say that the producer perhaps maybe could have decided the other way, but there are 100 of these decisions. We make decisions sitting in here as to what we can and can't say all the time. So I don't think these things are simple. What I didn't like so much about this story, I mean, it's on the front page of the Sun.
It shouldn't be a front. I don't think it's a front page story. I think it's naughty Joe Brand shouldn't have said that. In light of acid attacks, in light of attacks on politicians, that's not clever.
Yeah.
But it's not front page. No, but it's not bring down the BBC.
No, well, that's the point. That's the wider issue of this. We were sitting in here yesterday talking about the BBC, weren't we? And talking about the licence fee for the over 75s. And the Sun and the Mail as well have gone big on it because it's another thing. It's another stick to beat the BBC with, in my opinion. I think that's why they've gone so big on it. Look what they're not. Listen, pensioners are sitting in darkened rooms and they can't afford TV and radio. And in the meantime, this horrible left-wing woman is making disgusting jokes about attacking people with battery acid. And of course, when you just say it like that, it sounds terrible. There's been calls for a probe by the police, by Scotland Yard, into a joke. Yes, perhaps in slightly poor taste, but since when did the police... I'm sorry, I hear stories all the time about people aren't getting burglaries. Listen, we'd love to investigate your burglary, but we're looking into the poor taste of Joe Brand's battery acid joke. I mean, give me a break. I don't like the tone. I don't like the tone of this debate. I genuinely don't. And I'm like I say, reading the Mail this morning, which has been banging on about the BBC for a long time. And you made some very interesting points earlier when we were discussing it outside, Andy, about the BBC and their remit. And I think there's certainly discussion to be had. But this stuff, I mean, this is not a new story.
And we've got to be careful what we wish for, haven't we? These same titles will be complaining, as I've complained in the past, that the jokes are becoming a bit too woke.
It's all bland. It's all so bland.
It's all a bit woke. And then it'll be actually, you know, she shouldn't have made this joke. She shouldn't have gone out on air. But calls for cop probe, hysteria about it is far too
much. I think Frankie Boyle should be the controller of the BBC.
Oh, no, I'm not a Frankie Boyle fan.
Well, see, come on. See that we all have different tastes, but I'm just saying that's who I would have.
No,
then we'd find out what poor taste was about. It'd be absolutely brilliant. Thanks, Andy.
This is Love Sport.
It's time for the big debate. Myself and Jimmy Carter are here, and we're talking about Michael Holding. Now, there was one of the World Cup cricket games, West Indies against Australia the other day, and there was a mistake. Basically, the umpire made a mistake. Chris Gayle was out to a no ball, and the next ball should have been a free hit. Wasn't given as a free hit. He got the LBW. He was LBW and was given out. If he would have appealed, it would have he wouldn't have been given out, but he didn't appeal, and so off he went. Michael Holding, commentating for Sky Sports, which is showing all the Cricket World Cup, said that the umpiring was atrocious. And then in the papers this morning, they're saying he's been rapped on the knuckles. Has been warned by the ICC's broadcast partners not to criticise umpiring at the World Cup. Now, I don't quite understand why he shouldn't do that. I mean, I understand that you don't want to be too hard on the officials because they're doing the best they can. But in the end, they made a big mistake. And if he didn't call it, it would be ridiculous, wouldn't it?
It'd be really strange if Michael Holding hadn't mentioned it. I mean, I think the fact that it's cricket as a sport is probably been blown out of all proportion. I mean, can you imagine, you know, a referee in the Premiership?
Example? Why has it been blown out of all proportion in cricket?
Well, because, you know, he's used the word atrocious. For me, it is blown out of proportion because, like I was just going to say, if that was the Premiership, for example, and say, like, I don't say Gary Neville, for example, said, you know, at half time, oh, the referee, you know, is appalling and he made an atrocious decision, that would be acceptable because it's
totally acceptable because he'd probably be right.
Exactly right, and that's exactly what Michael Holding's done. He's actually made, you know, he's given his opinion. I think that the fact that he's mentioned the word atrocious, I mean, for me, that's not too big a deal.
I don't think it's that bad. I mean, maybe it's the way he said it, but I imagine he said, well, that umpiring was atrocious because he got it wrong.
Yeah, I mean, could he have said, you know, that the umpire could have done slightly better there? But that's, you know, it's, you know, sports passionate. All sports are passionate. Yeah, and Michael Holden is a passionate. He's an ex player.
Ex-West Indies bowler who's watched the best West Indies batsman go out when he didn't need to go out.
Exactly.
Atrocious is the least he should have said.
So feelings and passions were running high at the time when he was actually being interviewed. And of course, he just came across and gave his honest opinion. Now, you know, does that mean that, you know, pundits shouldn't be as honest as they have to be honest? And also, if he hadn't said anything, all the spectators around the world would have been thinking, hang on a second, what's up with Holding? Yeah. Surely he's got to give an opinion on that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've complained so much about football pundits not having enough of an opinion. And then when they have an opinion, that we go, oh, yeah, that's what we want. So if you cannot have it both ways. Yeah. I'm reading that European club rugby officials contacted BT Sport and other channels to complain about pundits criticising referees in October 2018. It was over a crackdown on dangerous tackles and pundits were criticising refs for giving out too many red cards and said the game had gone too soft. All right, well, that's another example. Again, I mean, they're criticising the referee, but it sounds like they're criticising the referees for basically administering the laws as they were. When they changed the laws, they went, right, we have to give out red cards for dangerous tackles. That was a dangerous tackle. That is a red card.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand that officiating in any of these major sporting events is tough. Is a very, very Without difficult job. But they're not above criticism, are they?
They're not.
Umpires and referees?
They're not. And you just wonder whether or not the actual umpire himself was actually, you know, deeply offended. It just seems that the cricket authorities have come down heavy on this, and that's and maybe looked at the likes of Holding with his comments, maybe bringing the game into disrepute. But maybe if you ask,
why is he bringing the game into disrepute?
Well, in my opinion, it's not, and you know, it's all subjective, isn't it?
You know
it?
What I mean, brings the game into disrepute? Wrong decisions.
Well, exactly.
I think
right.
That's disreputable. Wrong decisions, because Chris Gayle can hit 100 or 47 balls or whatever, yeah, and take the game away from any team in the world,
yeah.
And if the West Indies go out of the World Cup by 1 point because they lost this game, yeah, that was that decision that did it,
and that will be looked upon for years to come as that actual decision to put West Indies out of the World Cup.
What other word would you use aside from atrocious? I mean, you could use terrible, you could use awful.
Well, that's the thing. If Holding had come out, Ian, and said that was a terrible decision, that's terrible, you know, umpire, would he be in the same? Is it the word atrocious that they've got offended by?
I've never ever thought before that atrocious would be a terrible word.
It's not even that bad.
No, I don't believe it is. I mean, look, we understand that when officials get a load of abuse from the players, yeah, and the pundits can't be seen to support stuff like that, mm-hmm, but that then translates to local playing fields and referees on Hackney Marsh is getting attacked, and we've seen that happen, and mm-hmm, it's very hard right now to employ, to get, mm-hmm, any referees to do the job, particularly in football, because of the trouble they're getting. But I don't really think that has anything to do with what Michael Holding said. I mean, I genuinely don't. I think Michael Holding, made a point, didn't he, about the umpiring?
Just giving his opinion.
And I think he was right. Now, Paris has come in, right? It's good that Paris has come in, because I wanted to speak to Paris, because Paris is a qualified referee. If you've made a decision that is incorrect and somebody described it as atrocious, I guess you would think, you know what? It would be nice if you could explain why you made the decision. I guess you'd like a right of reply.
Obviously, you'd like a right of reply. The thing, I can only talk about football refereeing. I can't talk about being, yep, a cricket umpire, obviously. The one thing that cricket umpire will have that I don't is a team. He'll have a team. He'll have someone in a box going, you know, who should perhaps have been picked up on it as well. He's not the only umpire out there.
No.
You've got two on the field, one in a box.
Someone
should have helped him. Like, in terms of being... Like, if I get a decision wrong, I get a decision wrong. It happens. When I talk to players before a game, I go, look, I've not come here to get a decision wrong, but if it happens, it's because I haven't seen it, and if I can't see it, I can't give it.
No, fair enough. But if you did get a decision wrong, and let's just say for whatever reason the game was being televised and major players were commentating on it and basically said, that McAuliffe referee bloke is atrocious, do you think... That would be a suitable way to describe it if you'd made a really bad call.
Now, if they could call the decision atrocious.
Yeah.
Now,
I think that's all he said.
Yeah, which is all you could do. If you say that referee's atrocious, that's probably not correct.
That's personal, because, but he said the umpiring, not the umpire.
The umpire, that decision was incorrect.
Yeah.
And if a football referee makes an incorrect decision, they should be able to go, yeah, I got that wrong.
Do you think there's any link between the way that Michael Holding talked about the umpire in that sort of disrespectful way, or the umpiring, and I mean, we're talking about two different sports here, but we know that football pundits will have a go at referees. Do you think there's any link between that and the sort of stuff, the sort of abuse that referees have to put up with from players on a Sunday pitches up and down the country?
I think it's less the pundits. I'm talking solely football. Although in cricket, there was things behind it with, you know, local umpires getting attacked by players.
Yeah.
If players are seen to do it, then Sunday league players will do it. You know, if you're watching a big game and, you know, it was Roy Keane pushes a ref over, you go, right, okay, players go, oh, that's how I treat referee. That's fine, I can do that to a referee.
I think this is two separate things,
I know,
isn't it, really?
But that's basically, if you're a pundit talking about it, not so much. If you're talking about a decision and the decision is wrong, the pundit has to say the decision was wrong.
What about throwing milkshake over a referee or an umpire as opposed to battery acid? Do you think that would be okay?
You'd have to catch the referee first. Some of the referees are quite
fit. It's another level,
don't it? But yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend the milkshake.
No, or the battery acid. We do
milkshake
understand.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, officials are respected in rugby and cricket, but less so in football. You know, I mean, we say they're wrong, but it's the bodies, they crack down on any dissent from pundits. That's what they want to be doing.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between...
I don't think it's dissent. from pundits. I think it's just calling it.
There's a difference from... Basically, there's a lot of pundits who get it wrong.
Yeah.
So I watch them and say, oh, that decision was wrong. And you go, no, that decision was spot on, mate.
Yeah.
You're the problem here.
There's plenty of play. I mean, people moan about Robbie Savage. People moan about Steve McManaman. There's various ones.
They don't know the rules of the game.
Well, and that does happen sometimes.
So you cut across to, like, BT's Peter Walton or Howard Webb used to do it for the BBC. And they go, actually, that decision was spot on. And then the commentator wants to continue the argument. You go, no, you can't. There's no... Yeah. It's a rule. It's like watching it, you know, you can't argue with a correct decision.
As long as the attacker gets the benefit of the doubt, that's
Don't
my
start.
Only thing.
Do not start with that.
It's always... Anyway, look, listen, what do you think? Listen, thank you, Paris. Do you think that Michael Holding was right to criticise the umpiring and say it was atrocious? Because... I think it was. It's just whether he should say it or not.
This is Love Sport.
This morning, watching the highlights of the Women's World Cup, Germany had another win, beat Spain 1-0. They're looking strong as well, the Germans. The USA obviously are the favourites. And Wendy Reynard scored the most ridiculous own goal that you'll ever see. Do you ever get an own goal when you play?
No, never scored an own goal. Never scored many goals, full stop.
Yeah, you were more provider.
I was more assist than provider. Well, provider, they call it assist now, don't they?
They do call it assist. They do, yeah. And those stats mean a lot. I mean, when we saw, who was it, Jorginho last year, not a single goal or assist.
No.
And people were looking at it. I mean, even though he made probably more passes than anyone else in the Premier League, but none of them.
But what's it mean?
Well,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah, but you know what? In the same way that I remember watching Arsenal last year, Mesut Ozil played a pass inside the fullback to Hector Bellerin, who then crossed for Aubameyang to knock it home.
Yeah.
Now, Bellerin gets the assist.
Yeah.
Bellerin gets the assist there.
Yes.
But Ozil was the one who made the goal. He was the one who basically changed the dynamic of the game.
Yeah. So arguably, is that an assist? Assist?
It's an assist. But the thing is, nobody really talks about that. And I think in the end, you know... There's a point, isn't there? A pass that happens that changes everything.
Yes.
That suddenly changes that one team are coming out and the other team are caught by just a brilliant bit of skill. Now, you won't even get a mention in that regard. I saw Arsenal score a goal years ago where Dennis Boakam played a beautiful ball inside the fullback. Wiltord ran on, crossed it for Thierry Henry.
Yeah.
That was all about Boakam,
goal. Yes.
But Wiltord got the assist and Henry got the goal. Yeah. No one was talking about Dennis, except for everyone in the stadium, of course, who were just going, my God.
Well, you were very lucky to witness Boakam over a number of years.
But that's the beauty. That's the point I'm making, really, that these stats... don't tell the whole story. Jorginho might have played lots of passes to fullbacks who then cross for Hazard or whatever to score a goal. Doesn't, you know, Jorginho's not getting any credit for it.
Yeah.
Is all I'm saying.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, Jorginho's stats don't read the best, do they?
Not particularly.
Not particularly, no.
Now, talking of the Premier League, the fixtures come out in about 15, 20 minutes' time and we will be talking about them. Meanwhile, Manchester United have finally completed the signing of the Welsh winger Daniel James for £15 million from Swansea City. But chaos still seems to reign supreme at Old Trafford, with chief exec Ed Woodward seeming to have ruled out an approach for a technical director this summer, leaving him or Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in charge of acquisitions. Joining us now is the former Manchester United winger and friend of the show, Willie Morgan. Good morning, Willie.
Ian, good morning.
Nice to speak to you.
Enjoying the summertime.
The weather is glorious, Willie. The weather is glorious.
Killing my golf. It's absolutely killing my golf.
Is that right? I thought the whole idea with golf, Willie, and listen, I'm not a big golfer, but I thought the whole idea is it's not proper golf unless the wind is blowing and the rain is coming down.
Absolute garbage. Who ever told you that?
Do you know what? I don't know, but I just heard it. But apparently, okay. Now, let's start with Daniel James. You like this kid, young, pacey winger? You must see a bit of yourself in there.
Ian, I haven't seen the kid play, got to be honest. But one or two lads who have seen him, he's a winger. He's a proper bloody winger.
Yeah.
And how long have we been waiting to get a winger? We don't have one. Not had one for years.
No, not
and
really, no.
At least you can tell that Ole wants to play attacking football. So he gets somebody who can provide chances for the people up front. I think it's a great move. I don't know how good he is, so, I mean, I can't comment on that. But it's the right move in the right direction.
Yes, and okay, well, that being the case, when you're saying the right move in the right direction, are you talking about young players who are hungry and with potential?
No, players who can play in a position. and right. you know, not jack of all trades who play anywhere and don't do nothing. You know, that's what we've got at the moment. Yeah. They all play anywhere, but there's no specialists. I want a kid who say, I'm a winger. That's my job. I'm going to be in the wing. I'm going to be the fullback, and I'm going to create chances.
Yeah.
That's what I'm there to do. I'm not going to hide, go in midfield or drop back or... No, that's his job. I hope he signs another one to play in the other wing and start getting attacking football again.
Yeah, I mean, Willie...
That's my hope anyway. But, you know, it's going to take him a long time, Ian.
It will.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, over the years as well, Willie, that, you know, Manchester United have had some great wingers, you know, Gordon Hill and the likes of them sort of guys. And, you know, the Manchester United fans, they just love positive football and exciting wing play, don't they?
Well, just attacking play. You know, just the fact that you've got two wingers who play on the wing and take people on. I mean, we've got Lingard who plays... He's not a winger.
Not a winger, no.
He's not an
Martial,
winger,
you know, Martial. Everyone talking about Martial. Yeah, I'd have a strop if I was him. He's a centre-forward, the lad.
Yes.
And he's been playing him on a wing. Every time he plays, he's not a winger. Then people say, oh, he's useless. But he's not a winger.
No, no.
He doesn't know the job. And it's unfair on him. I think if he played up front with Rashford, it'd be brilliant.
Well,
and with a couple of wingers to provide ammunition for them.
Willie, I wanted to ask about Marcus Rashford. I mean, Marcus Rashford, amongst others, David De Gea as well, 12 months left on the contract, haven't signed a new contract yet. I mean, do you think it's... I mean, I was talking about this. I think De Gea is replaceable. I think Romero's a good goalkeeper. But I think that Rashford, you can't lose a player like that. A young Manchester lad, pacey, could be a superstar. Do you think that they need, as a matter of some urgency, to get him to re-sign?
He's one of the two best players we got.
Yeah.
And De Gea is one of them, by the way. Don't say, but we will miss him because he has saved us time after time after time. He's been unbelievable the last two, 3 years, De Gea. And Rashford, he's arguably, for me, the only player we got. The rest of them, Martial, yeah. If you play him up front, centre-forward, I think he would do a job as well. I think he'd be a good player. But the rest of them, no, I'll tell you what, the feet wouldn't touch the ground. I'd pay somebody to take them. You know, get rid of the lot. Pogba, Fred, gee, Matic.
Not Sanchez, surely not Sanchez.
No, Sanchez has been absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. What about Gareth Bale?
That's not been on a Saturday, that's been on a Sunday when there's no game.
Yeah, what about Gareth Bale? There was talk about maybe Gareth Bale coming back to Manchester.
You know, yeah, it'd be all right. You know, I don't know. I've not seen, obviously, the fact that he's playing over there. I very rarely see him play.
Yeah.
I worry why the manager there wants to get rid of him. Zidane, why would he want to get rid of him? There must be a reason he wants to get rid of him.
Yeah.
And, that would be a worry. But I don't know without having seen him play. But he's still be an improvement in what we got. Without a doubt, you know, I'd bring him in tomorrow.
Willie, I just want to ask you, there's been lots of suggestions that a director of football was going to be brought into at Manchester United. Woodward, he seems to have done away with that idea for now. There was talk about Rio Ferdinand coming in, which he seemed responsive to, but that doesn't seem to be happening now.
I've not had a phone call yet, Ian.
you've not had a phone call, no, Willie? No?
Not yet. Anyway.
Maybe later on. But do you wonder, actually, who's in charge of what players come in and which ones go? Do you think that it's a total mess now?
Tell me something. The only thing that will save Man United now, if Ollie buys his own players or tells them who he wants, that's what I want, go and get him. Woodward's not going to pick a player. He has no idea.
No.
He's never played the game. He's in a job. He doesn't want anyone to come in to undermine his job. And neither would I if I was in his position. He knows nothing about football. So why is he buying the players from Man United?
Yeah, perfectly fair question.
The manager has to buy the players.
Yeah, totally agree.
Willie, we'll no doubt talk more about this through the summer and into next season. You're going to find out in about 10 minutes time who you're playing in the first game of the season.
So I know. I'm just sat here waiting on say.
Yeah, there's going to be potential banana skins everywhere, is all I'm saying.
I hope we've got Accrington.
Yeah, local derby. Outstanding.
Give us a chance to get off the good note.
Willie, great to talk to you as always.
Thanks, Ian. Really. And Jimmy, hey, take care. Have a good summer.
See you soon. Mate. Enjoy the golf. That's Willie Morgan there, former Manchester United winger. Talking about their new winger, by the way, Daniel James, indeed. 15 million pounds from Swansea. He's got pace, the guy. He's got pace, the kid, and he can play. But playing for Man United is a step up. Is a step up in terms of the pressure on you, how magnified everything is. I mean, you play for two big clubs, Arsenal and Liverpool. Yeah. And you came from Millwall, though, right?
Well, Millwall to Liverpool.
Right.
And Liverpool to Arsenal.
When you went from Millwall to Liverpool, and this is not having a go at your old team, having a go at Millwall, but when you went from Millwall to Liverpool, you must have thought, oh, this is different here, right?
It is different. I mean, but that, you know, to get the preparation that I had at Millwall, the old den, it was intimidating, very hostile, especially for the away fans. That was my grounding. So when
that helps,
that helps.
But I'm talking about how you're under the microscope at a bigger club.
Yeah, but it's you know, if you've got any ambition, and most footballers have that ambition to want to play, want to do your very best and be the best that you can in your career, you know, you're waiting for that moment to possibly, you know, I love my time at Millwall, but when Liverpool came in, they were league champions, and they were handpicking players to come in and slot into their team. It was a great boost for me, and I remember stepping out on my debut at Anfield, you know, in front of the Kop.
Did the other players help?
Yeah, absolutely.
When you turned up there, were they encouraging, or were they a bit more like, who's this bloke? Let's see what he's like.
It wasn't like that, but there wasn't also over the top encouragement. It was like, you know, they knew that obviously I'd been brought in, and that Liverpool would have watched me for a number of months.
You're not a complete novice. That's the point.
And I would have played against them as well. And, you know, so I played against Liverpool a couple of times, so they would have known about me. So it wasn't like I was coming in as a complete stranger but the lads were great. They were absolutely fantastic.
When I did, I remember, like, when I was starting out doing comedy, and then I did one of the big clubs, and I was on with some comics who'd been doing those clubs for quite some time, and one of them, bless him, Tim Clark, I'll say his name, right, he was very nice to me. He said, you're here because you deserve to be here. Yes. And I really appreciated that. Those sort of comments make a big difference.
It just calmed you down on the night.
It did.
Yeah.
It did.
Nice.
The Team Ineos principal, Sir Dave Brailsford, said, it's always traumatic when a cyclist suffers serious injuries like Chris Froome. The four-time Tour de France champion has been ruled out of next month's race after fracturing his leg, elbow and ribs in a crash at the Critérium du Dauphiné. So Dave insists they'll be doing all they can to help his recovery.
Our first primary thought is for his care, make sure he gets the best medical care now as he possibly can. Think about his family, make sure they're okay. And in the meantime, then obviously continue to race and focus on the races coming up in due course.
Joining us now is the editor of the cycling podcast, James Rowe. Morning, James. Such an innocuous thing. He's blowing his nose, takes his hands off the handlebars and crashes into a wall at 54 kilometres an hour. It's incredibly unlucky for him, isn't it?
It is, but it's one of the things that can happen in cycling. Obviously, it's a dangerous sport and they're travelling at high speeds, and it's something that can happen to anyone at any time, whether it's in a train ride or in a race. I mean, yeah, Froome last night, he went into intensive care in Saint-Étienne. He has a fractured hip. An eyewitness said he had an open fracture of the femur. So pretty serious stuff. But, I mean, what does it mean for Froome and his career? Well, definitely he's not going to be coming back this season.
No.
Pro Cycling Database, Pro Cycling Stats said a rider that's injured their femur after May 15 hasn't ever come back in the same season since they've started their records. But that said, my colleague Daniel Free suggested that some riders have come back in the same season. There's an Australian guy, Jack Bauer, and Alexander Vinokourov, who also came back from a crash, and he was age 38. So it is possible. And there's obviously other cases like Alejandro Valverde, who famously smashed his kneecap a couple of seasons ago, and he went on to win the World Championship. So it's not impossible, but it's not looking good for him.
No, and the fact that, of course, after what happened in the Tour last year with Geraint Thomas sort of becoming the lead rider when they realised he had a better chance of winning. I mean, Chris Froome going to want to come back in the team and basically be a domestic for Geraint Thomas at 35?
Yeah, I mean, anything can happen. It's, well, I mean, clearly, Ineos have still got the strongest team, so they're still going to be going to the tour with the strongest team, because that's just a fact. I mean, Geraint Thomas, as you said, Egan Bernal, Pavel Sivakov, Ivan Sosa, they've just got a roster of people, any of a whole handful of them could be Grand Tour winners. But I mean,
yeah, but you know what I'm asking, you know what I'm asking the question. I mean, essentially, yeah, he's going to have to do the dirty work for Geraint Thomas, and is he going to want to do that at his age, having won the Tour de France four times? Do you think, you know, is he going to be motivated enough to come back knowing he's not probably going to win the Tour again?
I don't know. I mean, it's not definite, but it's difficult to say. It's difficult to say. I mean, obviously, you've got to be of a certain mindset to win a Grand Tour, and you've got to be sort of with a singular focus. And if you know you're the best, you sort of assert that position in the team and in the peloton. So, yeah, after missing out and coming back, it would be perhaps difficult for him at this time in his career. And it's unfortunate because, obviously, he already holds five Tour de France victories, which puts him on par to be the fourth best Tour de France competitor of all time. And so he's likely now going to miss out on stepping onto the podium in those Palmarès, where he would become the third best with just one more victory, and then the best of all time with two more Tour de France victories. And it's still not impossible. Cyclists are getting older. They're riding until they're older and older. I mean, Alejandro Valverde, he won the World Championship last year, 37. When he won that, and Froome has said it, that he's still feeling good, and he'll, as long as he's feeling good,
then maybe, yeah, then we'll see. We shall see, Jonathan. Thank you very much for joining us there, Jonathan Rose, cycling podcast editor.
Love Sport.
Joining us now is the golf journalist Ben Coley. Good morning, Ben.
Morning, gents.
McIlroy says his preparation has been perfect, and he's in good form, isn't he?
Yeah, I don't think you can prepare any better than winning by seven shots. So, yeah, he's absolutely right. And, you know, some of the things he did well last week, if he does them well again, he'll expect to contend. It was certainly pleasing to see him putt so well. And if he can keep that sort of freedom on the greens, then, yeah, he should perform better than he has, because this has not been a good event for him ever since he won it, really.
Yeah, and he's, like I say, he's flattered to deceive. And even hearing that interview there, when he's talking about his preparation for each event, I mean, he seems to be tinkering, but right now he's in a good place, so we hope it goes well for him. Obviously, there's Brooks Koepka is the favourite, won the US Open the last 2 years. Do you think this course suits him?
Well, I'll tell you what, if he wins this, I think it'll be the most impressive of his, that would be five majors since 2017, because really, it doesn't. I think the one thing that ties the other four in together, the other four courses at which he's won, has been that you can basically reach for driver on every single tee apart from the par threes. Here at Pebble Beach, he said himself he thinks he'll probably use it four times around. And when that's your chief weapon, and it's the same for McIlroy, it does bring the field closer together somewhat. So, no, I don't think it really does suit him. But obviously, given that he's been so effective in the majors for a period of years now, it's not to say I'd rule him out. I think he'll have to have other parts of his game show what they can do rather than rely on the driver, because it was the driver that powered his win at Bethpage last month.
Good stuff. Ben, just going to ask about Tiger Woods. Obviously, you know, he's back. He's won a major now. Do you think he's got a chance in the US Open?
Yeah, I mean, the way he won here back in 2000 by 15 shots, it was probably the greatest golfing performance we've ever seen. He nearly won it in 2010 as well. So coming back to Pebble Beach brings back fond memories for him. I think we have to accept that we are talking about a different golfer now. He does things differently. And I think there'd be a slight issue that he plays a lot of his best golf now closer to his new home in Florida than his old home in California. That being said, he played really nicely at the Memorial Tournament 2 weeks ago. Like McIlroy, it's a nice way to prepare. And a lot of people think Pebble Beach is a test of iron play because the greens are so small. You've got to be really precise with your irons. There's never been a better iron player than Tiger Woods, and I think he's probably still just about the best in the sport now. So, yeah, he has a massive chance.
What about the Europeans? I mean, we talked a little bit about McIlroy, Molinari. I mean, I know he missed. Did he miss the cut? Or he didn't play very well at Bethpage. But, I mean, are there any other Europeans? Tommy Fleetwood, people have been talking about him possibly winning a major at some point. What do you think?
Yeah, Molinari's gone off the boil since he hit his ball in the water on the 12th of Augusta, and all of a sudden this new transformed character sort of unravelled a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see how he plays. Fleetwood should play really well, being by the coast. Obviously, he grew up in Southport. That's going to suit him, and he's got the best US Open record of anyone bar Brooks Koepka over the last 2 years. So clearly he should take some confidence in there. We mustn't forget John Rahm. I know he doesn't always feel that European because he plays all of his golf really out in the States, but he's a guy who's played the course well before. He played college golf on the West Coast and he should go really, really well. And others like Paul Casey and Justin Rose, they're quality ball strikers, and that's yes. really the starting point at Pebble Beach. And just to mention as well for Graham McDowell, obviously won there in 2010. He qualified for the Open Championship last week. No one's happier in the world of golf right now than Graham McDowell, and we could see another good performance from him.
And I was also thinking about Jordan Spieth as well. Obviously, he had an amazing run a few years ago, hasn't quite hit the heights, but he feels like he's coming back into form.
Yeah, definitely turned the corner. The last three starts, he's finished in the top 10. That started at the last major in the PGA Championship, and he's won at this course in the PGA Tour event they hold here in February. So lots of good things for Jordan Spieth. He probably just needs to tidy up his iron play a little bit, but the putter is singing again. And when we think back to 2015, when he was the best golfer in the world, it was those 25-foot putts that seemed to go in at an extraordinary rate.
Yeah.
And they seem to be doing so again. So, yeah, he's full of confidence. I think that sort of speaks to the fact that this major is so well poised that it's hard to think of any world-class player who won't be really happy with their game going to a course which is iconic.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to it. Starts this afternoon. Thanks, Ben. That's golf journalist Ben Coley there talking about the US Open. Pebble Beach, I think first tee off is about 2 o'clock this afternoon. That's our time. Their time's about, you know, 8 in the morning.
Love Sport.
Thanks for listening to the Ian Stone Comedy Breakfast Podcast Edition. I'm back every weekday morning, 6:30.